Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Welcome to episode 529 with my guest Julie Kay. I'm Paul Gilmartin. Who are you? I've never asked you to introduce yourself. I can't believe that. I've been doing this podcast for 10 years. I'm so selfish. Anyway, we'll get to know each other. I don't know what this creepiness is I'm kicking the podcast off with, but I kind of like it and I kind of hate it. As I said, my name is Paul Gilmartin, in case you've forgotten. And this podcast, in case you've reached it by accident, is the Mental Illness Happy Hour. I am not a therapist. You've been forewarned. But I feel like I do have some input. It's valid. I've been in support groups for 17, 18 years and been in therapy for on and off for 30. You're probably saying, well, you haven't gotten any better. Why should I continue listening? I have gotten better. How dare you? How fucking dare you come at me in the first 5 minutes of my podcast? All right, let's jump into some surveys. Oh, I should mention, too, that the this episode with Julie Kay was recorded pretty long ago, a couple of years ago. And the reason I held on to it for so long was she had a really bad cold when we were recording this. And I just kind of dreaded sitting down and having to edit out all the sounds of somebody hacking with the cold, but I'm glad I finally did, because I think it's a great conversation, and she's just a really cool person. This is from the Struggle in a Sentence survey filled out by Jennifer C. And this one is so good. About her depression, she writes, "Depression is anger without the enthusiasm." Oh my God. That is so fantastic. That is so fantastic and so dead on, and I am absolutely stealing that. You will get no credit. None. In fact, when I say that on a talk show or any place public, I will say that is my thought, and that is not from a listener. Is your name Jennifer C.? Which might sound a little suspicious. And say, I think he's compensating. I think that might have been from Jennifer C. This is from the Struggle in a Sentence survey filled out by a teenage guy who calls himself Permanent Do Not Disturb. And about his ADD, he writes, "That's a cool computer. I wonder what computers are made of. What's the element Tony Stark made in Iron Man? I gotta Google it right now." About his love addiction, "We've been together for 2 seconds. Maine would be a perfect spot for our wedding." Those are great. Thank you for that. JJ fills out the survey and writes about his depression. It's a hollow, empty, sad chest. And about his codependency, if you can't make me forget how sad I am, I'm not interested. Oh, that is fantastic. One of our sponsors for today, as always, is BetterHelp.com online therapy. If you have never tried online therapy, I'm a huge fan. I have a great relationship with my therapist, Donna. I've been talking to her for, God, probably 3 years now, and she helps me through so many areas in my life. I love not having to leave my house. And if you're interested in checking it out, go to BetterHelp.com/mental, and that's BetterHelp.com. And include the slash mental part so they know you came from this podcast. And check it out. If they have a counselor they feel is a good fit for you, they'll pair you up with one, and you can experience a free counseling, a week of free counseling to see if that's your thing. And they are licensed in all 50 states. And then finally, these are some happy moments filled out by a guy who calls himself Nothing Bagel. This is a woman who calls herself Nothing Bagel. And she writes, Super Bowl Sunday 2021. I do not know who is playing, and that's okay. I only felt the familiar flood of I should thoughts for a moment this year. I should know who is playing. I should be more into this. I should at least watch the halftime show. I should make some festive snacks. And then I just let it all go. I do not like football, and that does not mean that anything is wrong with me. It does not mean that I am not a good American, whatever that is. Maybe it's COVID, but it just feels like a little bit of the pressure of these things has lifted. I hate to say that this pandemic has been peaceful for me when it's brought so much pain to so many, but I do feel like the anxiety and disappointment that lives deep within me has been dispersed among the population, and I can breathe a little easier. I do not have to carry it alone or feel left out. The pandemic has showed us all how fragile life is, that everything about how you live your life can change in an instant, that we really don't have any control over the future. So today I went for a walk. I love peering into open windows and hearing sounds of human connection drift out of cracked patio doors and garages. When you say peering into windows, I hope that you mean that as you pass by the house, you're looking at an open window, because it's completely different if you're like, I love pressing my nose against the glass when it's dark out and I know they can't see me. I used to do it to feel sad. I think I used to do it to feel sad, to remind myself that those sounds of normal life do not belong to me. But today, I felt connected and happy, not lonely. All of the, quote, want that I used to feel never surfaced. The want of more friends, the want of a happy family, the want of being able to mindlessly chatter over spinach artichoke dip and beer. I'm learning about the deeper wants of my soul. I'm learning that jealousy has no place when you realize that we are all in this together. So I just basked in the happiness of watching a child ride her bike. I smiled at the couple chatting on their patio, watering their plants. I giggled at the group of guys clapping and hollering while watching the game on a beat-up couch in their garage. A beautiful hummingbird zipped past my face and then onto a red feeder nearby. I looked up at the wispy clouds floating in the blue sky. And in that moment, I felt so at home inside of myself. Just a small human being walking on this unpredictable, undeniably connected planet.
I just wanted to get the fuck away from my life.
You know, I couldn't have felt any lower.
Grief, guilt, shame.
Why wasn't I born a girl?
There's a switch that gets flipped in my head.
I'm supposed to be a girl.
I experience being treated like an animal.
How can a just God...
I have a vomit fetish.
...let humans do this to each other?
Help!
I fucking flew over the cuckoo's nest.
My wife's losing it.
I thought it was all about me.
I don't know what to do.
I would have committed suicide if I could have watched my funeral.
A Polaroid I found of my mother, naked in a dentist chair.
And my body doesn't quite...
I think I did 8 days in L.A. County Jail.
...fit how I see myself.
What was it all for? Why are my friends dead?
Everything that I did...
There's a comfort in the scars for me.
...was in service of OCD.
You've already had all the paper cuts. Step away from the paper.
It's really hard to see the picture when you're inside the frame.
You know, it takes a larger view to see your life.
Just actually have somebody listen to you.
Yeah. And I got up and got my tooth and left.
I'm here with Julie Kay. We've corresponded a little bit. We got a bite to eat, learned a little bit more about each other. You turned me on to some of the best curry I've ever had here.
Veeraswamy.
Veeraswamy.
London's oldest curry establishment.
1926. It was good.
So good.
I love having like authentic English experiences.
Yeah.
Right? Well, I love how an authentic English experience is Indian food.
It's turned
food.
Into Indian, of course. Yeah. Absolutely.
I just love eating the food of places that they overtook. Mm. There's just something so nice about just a plate full of imperial power.
There is. I love imperial power. It's my favorite.
That's my favorite Indian appetizer.
Absolutely.
The issues that we're going to talk about today, among other things, is the struggles you've had in the past with shopping and gambling and coming from a wealthy British background. I don't think a lot of Americans know how classist the UK can be, or particularly England, how class conscious they can be, because for all of its faults, for some reason, America seems to be a place that it's really more about, they don't care so much about where you come from as much as how much you can buy today, how famous you are. So talk, if you would, about what your upbringing was like. Just give a sense of the kind of emotional context of what it was like, not only in your house, but in your area.
Okay, so I grew up in the suburbs of London, 3-bedroom, semi-detached house. My dad worked, my mum did part-time jobs, and probably middle class. So there's that kind of being middle class. That's kind of slight reservation, and also the...
Okay, so not upper class, middle class. I don't know why I thought it was
class. No, not upper class.
I guess because your pinky is always extended.
It is. It is, that's true. Yes. And the butler that I take around with me all the time,
And always looking through your opera glasses.
That's
which
true.
Which I found unnecessary.
Did you?
To push the elevator button? Did you need to look through opera glasses?
I suppose I didn't. You have got a point there, Paul. Okay. So that middle class thing, but there's always, but certainly not working class or lower class. And that's the distinction, is that I think that middle class, you're not born into money, but you have the... You want to do the best. So there's very much hence the expression of, you know, keeping up with the Joneses. It will be life's normal walk of life, but you're trying to better yourself. So anything that you do, you're trying to kind of impress the neighbours with, or guess where we've been? We've been to Spain this week. Oh, have you? Well, we're going to Portugal next week. And you're just trying to, you know, outdo people. Certainly that's how it was for me in the 70s growing up, or seeing my parents and neighbours try and outdo each other with the latest lawnmower or whatever it happened to be.
What was the kind of the emotional temperature in your house growing up? Siblings, relationship between your parents?
So I'm an only child, and so I've got no frame of reference for what it should have been like, because obviously not having had siblings.
We talked about you being an only child and me having the terrible memory. I'm scooting my chair around. That is not me farting. I'm actually farting. I'm farting as I scoot the chair around. It's a really great way to cover it up. But yeah, talk about being the only child.
Being an only child, I lived in a cul-de-sac?
Yeah, I grew up in a cul-de-sac.
A cul-de-sac. Yeah. So being there were other children that I could play with. But as an only child, my mom was always very protective of me. So whereas the others in the close would be allowed to walk to the end of the close or walk up to the local shops together. I was never allowed to. I always kind of felt that I'd missed out a bit. But then,
which is unusual in the 70s.
Yeah.
Really unusual in the 70s.
Yeah, so I wasn't allowed to go out of the circle of the close.
What? With the close is
The cul-de-sac, yeah, sorry. Oh, okay. So the cul-de-sac, I would only be allowed to go halfway down the cul-de-sac.
Until what age?
I don't know. Until I didn't really, I suppose maybe 13.
Wow.
Something like that. And then I would be able to walk somewhere as long as I was with someone else.
Because I know it's probably different for girls and boys in our society, mm-hmm. which I don't necessarily think it should be. Mm-hmm. But I remember being like 8 years old and we would just say, I'm going out to play.
Yeah.
I'll be back at dinner time.
And do you know what? That was pretty much how it was for my husband, who grew up as one of three boys. Yeah. That's what they would say. Right. Yeah, we're going out and we'll see you later. And they'd be off all day. Yeah. But whether it was just because I was an only child or whether it's because of my parents, I don't know.
Who did you feel like that directive was coming from?
Oh, definitely from my mum.
Okay. Had something traumatic happen to her as a child?
No, but she was an only child. And I guess that maybe she would have been protected like that by her parents, I guess. So, you know, as an only child of an only child, you can imagine how, mm-hmm. how overprotected, you know, I was. So, but growing up in the 70s, didn't want for anything, did as I was told, had a very happy home life. My dad, who I idolise and adore, worked for an insurance company. So he worked and would kind of alternate 2 weeks working daytime and then 2 weeks working in the evenings, collecting, you know, payments from people so that he could be around to help me with schoolwork.
Well, you know, as we were talking while we were eating, it's interesting that you said, you know, I came from this happy home, yet you were sharing these things about your mom. Mm-hmm. When you would achieve something, share with me what she would do.
Yeah, so it would be, I was a clever girl at school, and
you were top of your class.
Top of my class at junior school. Did great, did dancing, would win things all the time, competitions at dancing. I got into the secondary school that I got into. You had to be like the top 2% in the local area to get into there. Just everything would be perfect, but I know she would be proud of me, but the reason I would know that would be because I would hear her saying, oh, of course, my Julie, she's just got into such and such school, or of course, she just won the such and such. But it was never, I never felt that it was directed at me. And it's only just kind of now in my life that I've almost realised, thinking, actually, I know she was proud, but she was proud of my achievements rather than me. There was a bit of confusion around that. And I know that as an only child, I definitely tried to please her all the time. And it's only through listening to some of your podcasts about emotional availability that I've come to realise the difference in the relationship. So even now, I'll be, and I met my husband when we were teenagers, first ones to get engaged, to get a house, to have children. I have two children, one boy, one girl. Pretty much everything as would be, you know, perfect in inverted commas on paper. And, you know, I hear my mum, you know, say to people, of course, you know, my Julie, oh, yes, she met him at school. He went to the boys' school, very clever boy, and blah, blah, blah. He earns very good money, or he works very high up. There's a lot of pride in what I've achieved. But I can even say, guess what, mum? Usually it's just silly things like, I found a paint colour that I want to paint this. And there's always a caveat to it. It'll be, okay, great. Did you sort out the lights in the bathroom yet? There's always something which brings it down. Or I might say, guess what? I've tried this dress on to go to this party and it looks absolutely amazing. Oh, fantastic. Do you think you'll be okay if you don't wear high heels? Or, you know, are you sure that that's a good colour to wear? There'll be something that kind of detracts from it slightly that is a caveat to the, well done, that's brilliant. There's never that, there's always a, where do you think it'll be next? Do you think you'll also wear that to such and such? it's never kind of a complete appreciation, I suppose.
Yeah, it sounds like there was, like, she could never be still enough to have you be seen as mm-hmm. you are.
Yeah.
And I wonder if there has to be a word other than pride for what she felt, because to me, it feels like if you're not sharing your joy with your family member mm-hmm. who has done something, but you're only using it to try to impress other people, mm-hmm. that can't be pride. I mean, maybe that is the right word, but they're...
I don't know.
Schadenfreude.
It is Schadenfreude. That's right. It's the pride in the well-doing of somebody else. And the thing is, I don't even think that she realizes that she is doing it. And I don't think she would understand if she hears this podcast. She won't understand at all, because it's the same with anything. Her justification for things is because it comes from a place of love. But just because something comes from a place of love doesn't mean to say...
It feels like love to the other person.
Correct. That's right.
Because the most important thing, I think, is for it to feel like love.
Yeah, absolutely.
For the other person.
Yeah. So at home, it was quite... my parents, who are still married, so after 40 years, 50 years, God, long time. So they're still together. But it used to be volatile at home. My mum would fly off the handle, have rows. My dad would not know what to do. And I would find that quite early on in my life, maybe from the age of, probably about the age of 12, when I started going to grown-up school, I would be the person who was trying to mediate between the two of them. Which I think is why I still kind of enjoy mediating and getting involved in other people's business, being a nosy Parker, and saying to, trying to say to my dad, look, Dad, I think that my mum's point was that she was angry that such and such, and mum, you shouldn't have thrown the knife across the room, but, it was probably because you were feeling that Dad wasn't giving you enough thing. Am I right? And so even from like a really young age, that's kind of counselling 101 there, to try and get them to... See, that's that. But, my mum would storm out of the room, storm out and say, slam the front door and say she was going, and then she'd be back. And, but I'm not having any frame of reference or people talking about things at home.
Before we go any further, let's give a shout out to your friend Claire, who's a listener and it turned you on to this podcast.
She did. And I think, like I said to you, I feel like, when you have somebody, a friend, who introduces you to their friends, and then you end up being better friends than you were with the original one. So I think Claire was slightly miffed that I was going to meet you today. She should have come too.
I wish she lived here, because I would have liked to have said hi. Let's remember our thought that we were going to come back to, because there's one more thing I wanted you to share, because I think it's a great peek into... Yes. Not only your soul, but Claire's mm-hmm. soul as well. Mm-hmm. I assume she's okay with you sharing.
She's fine.
Epsilon
9. She'd be fine with this. And she'll be, as she says, she'll be absolutely laughing her head off. Okay. Because it's something that quite often we've each let slip with, and we've mentioned what Epsilon 9 is to people. And some people just don't get it.
Oh, I so get it. I so get it.
But yeah, she's one of my oldest friends that I've known since secondary school, and somebody who I can honestly say she fulfills the role of my intellectual husband, in that if I want to speak to somebody about, I talk about politics or subjects that my husband, when he comes in from a hard day of work and being talked at and talked to, he just wants to chill out. But because I do nothing all day because I'm a stay-at-home mum, all I want to do is talk to people about things. Mm-hmm. So Claire fulfills that side of my relationship. So she's my, husband that I speak to about all sorts of stuff. So I can speak to her about anything. And we have in common some mother issues. And when each of our mums does something particularly frustrating or particularly typical, we used to say, I've got a brilliant nuggets of mumness. So we've just shortened those down now to mum nugs. So, you know, the mum nugs are those snippets where you have classic thing. So, I mean...
And we were talking about what a great thing that is to have with somebody, because it when you experience one, it lessens the pain of it because you've got a great story to share with somebody.
It's exactly like you coining the awfulsome things. Anybody who listens to this podcast, well, when you hear the awfulsome thing, you're like, yeah, I totally get it, because you get it. So it doesn't become awful. It does become awfulsome because it is half awesome in its awfulness.
Yeah. There was a comedian, I don't know if she wants this shared, so I won't say her name, but she and her friend did a show where it would just be them going back and forth saying things that each of their moms said.
Yeah.
And one of the moms said, is he a Muslim or a Muslim in jail Muslim?
That's precious.
How did Epsilon 9?
So Epsilon 9 is, let's call it a coping mechanism, shall we? So as well as the kind of nuggets of mum, the mum nugs, we decided that, as you do when you're chatting one day to a friend and you just say, do you know what? I just like, let's just get out of here. Let's build a rocket. Let's find our own planet. For just you and me, this is how it went. Let's find our own planet. What we're going to call it? Let's call it, oh, I don't know. We'll call it Epsilon 9, and we'll just go on this planet, just you and me. We'll just have the people that we want there. So, and it started off a bit like the ideal dinner party of who are you going to have on the rocket, you know, blah, blah, blah. Of course, Patrick Stewart, he's going to be the captain. He's got, you know, he can be very amusing. And of course, he's got the Star Trek experience, make it so. And when we get to the planet, right, I tell you what I want. And the first thing we said was, let's have like just a place where we've got mountains of gifts, like all those presents that you buy for people that really you'd like. Let's have mountains, mountainous mountains. And we'll have our own like little postman dwarves who go off on little tiny Shetland ponies. And they're the ones, they have to climb up Present Mountain. The higher you climb, the higher the value of gift. So it's going to take longer to get the high value ones, which are further up, and then they can deliver it to us. And we started kind of going into this adventure fantasy land where each place or area was like a coping mechanism. So we have, I invented something called the rant room. And this is a room where when you've had a conversation with your mum that's made you want to scream, it's soundproof. You can just go in there. And you can scream as much as you like. No one's going to hear it. And you just get it all out of your system. And then on the walk out, you walk down a corridor. Lined in the corridor is all the figurines and all the shit that your mum tries to pass on to you, either through inheritance or because it's hers. I mean, it doesn't have to be China. It
could be despite you saying I don't want this.
Well, you should have it. Why don't you? So in the UK we have a China make that's called Ladro. It's a Spanish make. Ladro, and it's blue, and it's always beautiful, like a ballerina. It's either a ballerina or it's a Victorian boy with a cap. Sad little Victorian child with a cap. And no, I'm fine.
Was there a happy Victorian child?
Never. Always Victorian boy or a sad clown. Always some kind of...
Could I have more, sir?
Exactly.
Just a bit. I'm a wee bit hungry.
Just any excuse, Paul, for you to get in your little English Victorian waif. And so you have a rant room, and then all this stuff that your mum tries to kind of foist on you, you know...
Lining the corridor.
Anything. It's lining the corridor, and you can pick up bits and you can smash the shit out of it. Just throw it against the fucking wall. Smash, smash. So it gets, And so Claire and I would have this conversation. And as we're describing what we want and adding different pieces to it, of course, we're both laughing our heads off. But it's also very therapeutic and kind of saying, yeah, actually, what would I want in an ideal world? And the world is mine. What would I want? Mm-hmm. like I was saying to you earlier, when we were in Viraswama having our curry, I've in Epsilon 9, there is, I'm calling it the Popper Dome. So it's round like a poppadom, but it's got a big glass dome on the top. So you can see everything out, beautiful. And it just serves curry. Breakfast, lunch, dinner, 24 hours, just curry all the time.
Red curry?
Everything.
Every curry.
Every curry you can think of. And then after you've eaten, instead of it being a floor, it's just like a mattress to your left and right. Mm-hmm. And you just flop out of your chair, have a nap. And I've always thought that a restaurant with beds next to it is like missing out. You know, they're missing out on something there.
Oh, that's fantastic. One of the dreams that I used to have when I was a teenager was a bubble that you could get into that would have pillows like the I Dream of Jeannie bottle.
Yeah.
And you would get into this bubble and it would be in the Atlantic Ocean in the middle of a gigantic storm. Oh. You would be safe from the waves and you could just sit in there on the pillows and get high and watch the chaos around you that couldn't touch you. Yeah. Gee, I wonder why. I wonder that that was a metaphor for something. What were some of the other things on Epsilon?
So some of the other things on Epsilon 9, my favorites would be, I think this comes from being a parent and constantly warning children of not getting messy or being warned not to get messy or dirty. And that is, it's like a ride. You have to wear white. You have to wear white. And you know how it's sometimes at public swimming baths, you have that little foot, that awful cold foot thing that you have to
clean your feet off.
Well, that's like chocolate sauce. That's made of chocolate sauce. And then like a aquazoom. What do you call them?
A water slide.
Water slides. But instead of water, it's like cherry juice. So everything... and when you come out at the end, it's onto grass and mud. So basically, anything to get your white stuff stained and as filthy as possible. Because there's nothing quite like owning the fact that, do you know what? Get it dirty, wear the clothes, throw them away, start again. And I think that if I'd had that attitude towards stuff and not worrying about things so much, you know, that would have been helpful.
What about an alarm clock that wakes you up by slowly pouring hot fudge into your mouth?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And maybe the alarm clock itself has kind of got like almost like an extended, like a little hand or maybe a feather. Yes. Oh, something that just kind of touches your forehead.
Yes.
As it just soothes you awake rather than that kind of awful, that noise and maybe, where you hear an alarm clock in it.
And maybe it even says, we don't have to face the world.
Yeah.
It's your choice.
Fine. And did I tell you? You look so beautiful in that. You look beautiful as you are.
That pillow looks good on you. Actually, it would be you look good on the pillow.
You look so good on that pillow. That's right. Yeah.
The other one that we were, of course, when Julie told me this, I came up with five of my own.
Yeah, absolutely sold straight away.
And it would be like one of those rifles at the carnival that you use to, you know, like pop the balloons, but it shoots corks. And you have to try to shoot the cork into the mouths of people judging you using the Bible.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. That's great. That's a fantastic one. I know that as well. We've got one where it's like a lodge, like a wooden lodge, except it's not made of wood. It's made of bacon. So there's loads of different rashers of bacon. It's it's a savoury lodge. And you can go there and sit down and just, you know, shoot the shit and bite off a little bit of the banister, bacon banisters. And I started to even draw some of these and, you know, do illustrations for them, write down things, new languages, new words that we came up with. I mean, it's kind of a fully formed idea.
I think, we were talking about Julie and Claire turning it into an adult coloring book. I was like, we will totally sell that on our website. So getting back to, you know, it occurred to me as you were sharing about how you and Claire will laugh as you come up with mom nugs or ideas for Epsilon 9, that in essence, that is really what a good support group meeting feels
Definitely.
At least to me.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing is, and I think that I might have touched on this in an email to you, actually, when we were talking about, I think you'd asked if I was in any support groups. And I said that I actually had attended a support group. but that I didn't get on with it. And I have to say that anybody who says that they don't get on with a support group or counselling, I always tend to judge very harshly and think, find another support group or find another counsellor. But for me, the support group that I went to, I found that, and I don't know whether it's an English thing or not, but I found that it was, instead of being supportive, just, I did feel like I belonged there, mm-hmm. but I felt it was kind of glamorizing things rather than talking through things. I felt that, and it's like, although we laugh at shared experiences, mm-hmm. Which is that, I felt it wasn't so much a getting other people's shared experiences. It was almost like a platform for people
to glorify.
To glorify it.
And outdo each other.
Yeah, and I didn't enjoy it at all. I found it really counterproductive because it was kind of like saying, it's like going to, you know, support group for drugs and then going, but do you remember how brilliant it was when we used to do drugs? And it's like, I don't want to feel like that.
That, you know, that does happen at sometimes even at the best meetings, but the consistently good ones, in my experience, always come back to mm-hmm. the solution.
Sure.
Or people asking for mm-hmm. help and bringing it back to the issue, the why you're there. But mm-hmm. That is annoying when it gets away from the solution and it becomes one-upmanship.
Sure, and that's just that's how I felt. Was I kind of thought I'm not enjoying this because although of course I like a good story, but at the time it was like this is like joking about something which I don't feel is particularly funny.
Yeah, especially when you first roll in.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was in that support group for about 4 months, but. There's, you know, so I live in the southeast London suburbs. There's not an awful lot of choice. There are support groups for everything, but there's not a huge variety. So for me, it's the same. It's always going to be the same people at the same meetings. So I kind of gave up on that. But I found that certainly the support of my friend Claire, you know, another maybe one or two individuals, and also my counsellor. I kind of get what I need from a support group from them. Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about the spending addiction mm-hmm. and the gambling sprees.
This is quite recent for me, so it's still quite painful to talk about, but that's fine. Everything is. I found that, you know, and in the past, so I made reference to support groups, I found that I was drinking in a very destructive way when my mum got ill and that I didn't like the person it was turning me into. Started using drugs. My mum found a small amount of cocaine in my house, which, ironically, it was in my house and she'd been rifling through my stuff. Hence why she found it. And it, especially in... I'm going slightly off tangent, but you'll understand why. For somebody who she'd been so proud of, to find out that I was using drugs purely recreationally, and it was then, oh, she's like Amy Winehouse. Even that was kind of made into a, again, the pride and shooter. It was almost like an proud, anti-proud, but still proud. That there was a, you know, some... tragedy, you know, there was that element of, well, certainly that's how I felt, that even though it's something was negative, it was still something to be touted as, I don't know, not gossip, but I don't know, it's difficult to explain, but I found it very difficult saying to my mum and dad, look, you know, there's no problem, I haven't got a problem, you know, you can walk into any pub in the southeast London and score drugs anytime. But they didn't get it because they're from a different generation. So I was made to feel very much like, you know, I was Amy Winehouse and this is a...
And to be fair, I think any parent would be alarmed finding mm-hmm. cocaine on their kid because they don't... You know, let's put the issue aside that she was rifling through your shit and you were an
yeah.
adult. Let's
yeah,
put
yeah,
that
yeah.
aside. Mm-hmm. I think any parent... is understandably concerned finding cocaine. But it sounds like instead of talking to you about it, she just kind of made her mind up about
and I was ashamed very much. So it was already, I felt that I couldn't kind of say, look, but you don't understand, it's prolific, it's no biggie, or it's acceptable. I understand that you're concerned, but it was very much, I was very much shamed into what a waste, what have you let yourself, you know, become.
Instead of what's going on,
that's right.
Are you hurting? Mm-hmm. Is there something you're having trouble?
So kind of being shamed in that way, and also, you know, my mom telling my husband, and then my in-laws, I'm feeling kind of being made to feel very small, where, you know, there were other people that I knew that they knew that were also doing it, and I kind of felt like, you know, why am I the one being vilified here?
And how old were you?
Oh, this was like...
Monday?
Yeah. No, so, I mean, I must have been the early 30s. I mean, this is maybe 10, 12 years ago.
Wow.
Because I kind of led a pretty perfect life. And it's kind of, ironically, started going off the rails when other people, finally get their shit together. That's when I let mine go. And I went off the rails. I was the first of my friends to have children. There's less than 2 years between my two kids, who are now 16 and 14. So there was nobody for me. I had nobody. And having gone from somewhere where I've got a very busy brain, Paul, a very busy brain, to having to look after two kids, two babies, I found it exceptionally difficult. And I would, like, there was one time where I'd get the paper, and there might have been an article about, I don't know, obesity not being linked to fat or something. And then I would annotate. I'd get my biro and I'd annotate saying, is this sponsored by McDonald's, I wonder? or things. And, you know, or fast food, slow brains or something. And I would be having effectively a conversation with myself, writing it on paper like a mad woman, because I had nobody to share it with and no outpouring.
I've heard from a lot of people that are stay-at-home parents how hard it is for them to share honestly about the tedium of being a parent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you know what people tend to go, oh, being a mum, it's the hardest job in the world. It's not the hardest job in the world. I should imagine that is kind of bomb disposal or rocket scientist, brain surgeon. But it is the most dull job in the world. It's the most tedious is the right word in the real sense of the word. And I
always time consuming.
Yeah, yeah, time consuming. I liken it to, there's a Greek myth of Sisyphus, and he is tasked with rolling this massive boulder right up to the top of the hill, and he spends all day rolling up to the top of the hill. And as soon as he gets it to the top, it drops to the bottom, and guess what's in front of him? Another big hill. So to me, that's what it's like. It's that never-ending thing of, ah, do you know what? I think I've just got it to the top of it. Brilliant, that's done. Oh, down it goes. Start again. So it's, I'm not saying it's not worthwhile. I'm just saying it is hard and it's repetitive. It's like pushing a boulder up a hill and doing that over and over and over again.
Yeah, and I think sometimes people will say, well, you know, if you're going to complain about it, you made the decision to have kids, but I don't think, again, the two have to be mutually exclusive.
No.
It depends on who you're talking to about it. Mm-hmm. If you're telling your kids, listen, you're a pain in my ass, you don't understand how horrible this is. Yeah, that's correct. That would be incorrect.
Absolutely.
For you to do that. But if you're sitting with some other stay-at-home parents...
Well, this is it. You have to be able to share. Otherwise, that's like saying, you know, well, you know, do you ever want to say that, you know, your other half is getting right on your nerves? Mm-hmm. And that's like saying, well, if you're going to complain about them, you shouldn't have got married.
Right. So I was hanging out with some friends a week or two ago, and only one of us had had kids, one of the four of us. And he said to the three of us, honestly, if I had to do it over again, I wouldn't. He said, it's just too much work.
Mm-hmm.
And his kids are all grown now. So he's, you know, it's not like he's in the middle of it. But I thanked him for being so honest about that, because mm-hmm. I tend to think there are probably a lot of parents who feel that way but think that they would be a terrible parent for saying so.
Correct.
The episode with Ted Lied is a really good episode where he speaks very, very frankly about mm-hmm. Being a father and all the conflicting feelings mm-hmm. he has, and separating, I love these kids from, mm-hmm. I don't recommend it to
That's
anyone.
Right. I mean, it used to be that I can remember going to either taking the kids to nursery school or something and kind of saying, you know what, this morning, you know, they wouldn't go down to sleep or blah, blah, blah. And she played up during her nap time, and just saying, you know, sometimes I just think to myself, you know, is it, you know, maybe I should, get the booze out of the chocolate liqueurs and go for that. Make some kind of joke about it being stressful, whatever. And then you expect, you just want somebody just to say, tell me about it, or I know what it is. And then, but because everyone in, especially suburbia, again, it's so much kind of trying to keep up with the Joneses, it'll be like, oh really? Oh no, well, oh, mine not always sleep perfectly. And you just think, great, now you've just made me feel like shit. Yeah. Or, well, you know, well, I don't know. I was too busy because I had mine cooking some quinoa and oats, something that we grew in the thing. And you just think, oh, do you know what? I can't be doing with that.
So how did the shopping,
okay,
did that start before the gambling?
Yeah. And my husband has a great job. He works long hours. And I get bored. And I think it started with, this was kind of before I started having regular counselling. And, you know, people say a bit like some kind of food, or people who eat a lot, you know, trying to fill some kind of void. And I think the same could be said for me spending and shopping. And I look now and just think, I've got like so much stuff, just like too much stuff. And I consider myself a kind and generous person, but just because I am doesn't mean that I can't be a glutton as well as being kind, you know? Yeah,
people are complicated.
And kind of having reduced dramatically the amount of alcohol being drunk and not taking drugs, and also kind of trying not to buy so much shit, I started kind of one day just looking at online gambling, like the slot machine type things, which anybody knows is complete and utter mug's game. Completely. We know that it's rigged.
Rigged, yeah.
And yet it consumed so much of my time and ultimately, you know, money. And I don't want to talk about details, but I'm ashamed. Deeply ashamed.
Did the gambling follow the shopping?
Yeah.
Can we talk about what the, as comfortable as you are sharing the details of it, I because it's a little vague as to how bad it got,
yeah,
and what form it took, uh-huh, what it looked like, as comfortable as you are sharing the details of that, mm-hmm, so you can paint a picture for us, not for us to relish, yeah, your downfall, but sure, to understand what does a shopping addiction look like. And by the way, somebody wrote a beautiful guest blog on our website about a shopping addiction, and mm-hmm, how if you truly have a shopping addiction, it's not funny, like, you know, like, yeah, it's portrayed in, yeah, in the movies. It is because destructive.
It is, because it makes you feel important. Because, you know what, you can buy whatever you want. And for me, the worst and the most embarrassing thing about it was that my husband trusted me enough for a joint account, so his wages would be paid in. And, you know, I would be losing money by the thousands a day, maybe £1,000 a day.
Wow.
You know, not always. But the thing is, I didn't even realize that this was, I didn't even realize it was an addiction. It was just something that I did to fill the time and the boredom and to make me feel important. Because if you win something or you get something, it makes you feel like you've achieved something.
And you are something.
Yeah, and that you are something. And it's so strange because people kind of who, if I think of somebody gambling, I think predominantly blokes standing in the betting shop are thinking, come on, this one, it's got to win. I've got to win this one. I'm convinced it is. But for me, it was not like that at all because it wasn't, it was on the slot machines and, you know, or electronic slot machines. And I'm a clever girl. I knew it was a mugs game, but I didn't think that I wasn't aware of how much I was spending, for one. And, you know, my husband, whose money is coming into this account, who trusts me with it. And then, you know, we had some savings and I run through that. And it was, I was doing that for maybe, I did it for maybe about 6 months. And I mean,
how much money do you think you went through? Are you comfortable sharing that?
Do you know why I'm not comfortable sharing? Because I'm so ashamed. I'm so ashamed that my husband worked so hard. So hard. And I had so little respect. So little respect for it. But I mean, we're talking, you know, we're talking over $25,000.
Here's what I think when you share about it. You clearly have shame and regret about it. I don't see somebody who was selfish and disrespectful. I see somebody who was in so much pain that hadn't developed coping skills to deal with that pain and discomfort in being in her life and who she is. That's what I see. So I...
And it wasn't even kind of... It's difficult to say that it was even an addiction because I didn't feel a compulsion to do it. I just felt... It's so sad. This is the saddest thing, is that something like that should, like, the material possessions or the thrill of a win should make you feel, it's sad that that is what makes you feel loved or normal. And it's that which I find so sad. And the reason that I'm kind of tearing up as I'm talking, I am actually smiling, right?
Yeah.
But it's so bittersweet because I knew that I would get found out. I wasn't hiding it. It's not like I was selling something and sneaking this round. There was no sneakiness in it. I was doing it, but my husband trusted me with the bank account. And I just was pissing money away.
What was it like when you revealed it to him?
Well, he found it and I knew he would. And he said, what's this money? Oh yeah, yeah. And I said, yeah, no, it's fine. And I have to be honest that when he discovered it, I actually had no idea how much money I had lost. I had no idea. And do you know what? If he hadn't gone back through what was happening, I would probably still be doing it now.
You were just kind of in a fog of...
Yeah, I'd probably still be doing it now. But him kind of going back saying, well, what the hell is this? What the hell is this? And then saying, do you know how much... And don't get me wrong, there were times when I did win. I'm big on the slot machines. You know, once I won like £28,000.
What?
Yeah. But even with that win, that doesn't even begin to cover the losses.
No.
And I'm so ashamed. And it was at that time that he just said, that's it. We are done. We are through.
With you two as a couple?
Yeah, that's it.
And what did you think? And what did you think?
And I just thought, I don't blame him. I think there was that part of me that, I'm saying that I don't think I wanted to get caught out, but I wasn't surprised that I had got caught out. It's very easy to kind of look at it and go, I guess it was a cry for help. But it was certainly a subconscious cry for help, I think. But one that I wish I'd not... I certainly wasn't aware of doing it. And I certainly, if I could take it back, I would. If I could take it all back and go back in time, you know, I regret it hugely. But the funny thing is as well that, and having told this to my counsellor who I just started seeing at the time, it was very important for me to be able to tell my counsellor the truth at all times, like real warts and all stuff. And my counsellor said, I want you to go to a support group. But I knew that I wasn't going to go to a support group. And the reason was, it sounds like I'm in somebody, only somebody who's in denial would say, I wasn't addicted to gambling. There was no underhand sneakiness. It was, I was just spending money. I was spending money openly.
But you would agree that you were trying to fill an emotional hole.
Yeah, without doubt.
With compulsive activity.
Correct. Okay. Correct. And fill a void. And I think that as well, that kind of contributed to me becoming ill. I think that the stress of that and the upset as well that I knew that I'd caused my husband, and the fact that it was then potentially he wanted to divorce me. There was no, right, well, why did you do this? Let's talk about it. It was like, you've screwed it up. That is it.
But you did not divorce.
We did not divorce. And I think one of the main reasons was that I became, unfortunately, became ill and was hospitalised with a blood infection. And that's beyond intravenous drip. And I think that realising that for me, you know, things were not actually always as easy as maybe my husband thought they were. And also that he then had to spend time, you know, looking after the kids. And although the kids don't need much looking after because they're teenagers, I think it gave him an appreciation of what I do. And that actually seeing me vulnerable as well, there was nothing malicious in what I was doing. Oh, I'd been a prize idiot, of course, but there was nothing malicious. It was not about screwing him over. And
it wasn't about winning money.
No.
It wasn't about getting richer.
No, it was just about filling the void.
Yeah. And shopping, it doesn't sound like wasn't to impress people. Mm-hmm. It was just to...
Again, fill the void, feel validated. Mm-hmm. In fact, that's what it is, to feel validated. Because that's what I've been missing generally in my life, I think, is feeling validated.
You were sharing that you... really, really related to the episode with Dr. Janice Webb on emotional neglect.
Yeah.
Yeah, I highly recommend anybody who feels like, oh, you know, why am I so quote-unquote fucked up? I don't have anything to point to. Listen to that episode.
Definitely. Because
it might ring your bell.
I think it definitely will, because it's like, you know, having given you my background. So I grew up in Southeast London, quite a privileged background, nothing, perfect education, childhood sweetheart. I mean, and we say, oh, and I have one boy and one girl. What is not to love about that? What is not to love? On paper, you know, this is the perfect scenario. And even kind of thinking, well, I've got a beautiful house, got a nice large house in Kent, beautiful. But it's not always as it seems.
It's never.
It's never as it seems. And it sounds like... I think that people who have not got a big story never want to go, well, do you know what? I'm finding things difficult in my privileged lifestyle. Mm-hmm. Because you've got somebody saying, well, were you raped every day? Were you beaten up? Were you abused? Well, no. Well, then you shut up. And I think you then feel that you can't say, do you know what? I've got struggles too. Because it's like, oh, boo-hoo. Yeah. Did we not have enough hummus? Was there not enough artisan bread for you in the morning? You know, and it's like, that's what you feel like. You feel like you're being a fake. Yes, Mama said that the camembert had run out. It was terrible. We only had one butler. The footman wasn't available. You know, so you've got to keep it in perspective.
So how are you trying to fill the void in healthy ways today?
Well, when I was taken into hospital and hospitalized, it's so boring. So boring. So I was actually able to start redoing things like artwork. I did some tapestry. I did some knitting. I did some painting. And I started drawing and painting using paint onto, like, you know, like canvas tote bags. Mm-hmm. And I started realising that actually, do you know what? I'm pretty good at this. And so somebody had come in, one of the nurses had said to me, oh, that's amazing. Oh, my friend Janice, she loves cocktails and she likes shopping and she's just about to marry a French man. You couldn't design something, could you? And I painted and designed a tote bag, which had like a Parisian style street there, which with her friend with red hair who looked like that. And just thought, you know what? I can do this. If you tell me things about your friend, like what they like. I did one for my friend Ian and his Mrs. Joe. She loves the circus and loves the colour pink. So I started to do things like that.
And so is it something that you continue doing today?
Yeah. So I did some over Christmas and sold some to people. So, you know, for like 25 quid a bag, because it's something unique and I love doing it. But it's not a money spinner in that, you know, it takes me a long time to do it. And I loved it, but I just like creating things.
Yeah.
And bizarrely, I've realised that creating things, like a finished product, actually, that's what I crave. It's that validation from completing something.
And it sounds like it's not to show it off, but to just kind of see yourself.
Correct. So whereas I've been buying things, or, you know, was gambling to get that thrill and feel like a winner, I actually get exactly the same from doing something for somebody and making a bag, knowing that they will love it, and painting it. So really, that's all I needed to do. And it's like, part of me thinks, you fucking idiot, putting your marriage on the line and wasting all that. But you know what? It is what it is. And
maybe that's what it took for maybe, you to
absolutely.
Be willing to say, I need to dig a little deeper emotionally, because I've put some walls up around myself.
Absolutely. So for stuff which, and like I say, I've still got too much stuff, some of which I've started to sell on eBay, because I need to prove to my husband that I never did take advantage of him, or certainly that I didn't mean to.
That wasn't your intent.
Yeah.
Julie, is there anything else that you'd like to share?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've always wanted to say this. Go fuck yourself.
Thank you.
What a sweet, sweet human being.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
If you have not yet subscribed to this podcast, that is a great way to support us. We always appreciate any help you want to give, whether it's financial or non-financial. If you feel like donating to the podcast, either a one-time donation via PayPal or a monthly donation via Patreon, go to our website, metalpod.com. I believe we also take donations from Zelle. And by Zelle, I mean the character from the movie Marathon Man. Oh my God, what a dated fucking reference. Such a good movie. Zelle! The Weiße Engel! This is an awfulsome moment filled out by exasperated cat lady, and she writes, basking in the aftermath of an incredible orgasm from my new magic wand, when my normally very chill cat jumps onto the bed and begins attacking the vibrator. There's a long history of conflict between vibrators and cats. You guys remember the vibrator cat war of 72? Oh, the carnage left in the wake of that dark, dark time in our nation's history. In fact, if you're ever in Washington, D.C., I really recommend you visit the Tomb of the Unknown Vibrator. Of course, there's a soldier standing guard to make sure the battery never runs out. All right, is this riff ever going to end? No, it's not. This is from the Fears survey filled out by Fern, and she writes, I fear that if I overcome insecurity and discontentment, I will never get anything done and accept mediocrity. That is such a common fear. It's also why a lot of people avoid therapy or going on meds, especially creative people. They think that it's going to take away their edge. And I can say, from my personal experience, if anything, it broadens the palette of ways that you can express your creativity. The anger and the darkness will always be accessible. But you can also access emotions that were really hard to access. Sensitivity, joy. I know there are others. I just can't think of any others right now. This is an awfulsome moment filled out by T-Bear. And she writes, at the beginning of this year, I lost a close relative of mine and then experienced a miscarriage a month later. A few days after I lost the baby, my husband and I went shopping at a local grocery store. As I was crossing the sidewalk to go into the store, a vehicle almost ran me over. I glared at the person driving, shook my head, and kept walking. The car pulled up alongside me, and a woman yelled at me, "How dare you shake your head at us? Why did you walk in front of us?" Yada, yada, yada. I'm a very petite, short woman. Think 5'1", a bit over 100 pounds. I've never yelled at a stranger in public. I lost it. I yelled at the lady that they had almost hit me with their car. Her and her guy got out of the car and accosted me and my husband. The other guy called my husband fat, and I walked up to this tall man and yelled, "How dare you call him fat," etc., etc. I didn't give an inch and took out my phone to call the cops when they finally left us alone. It was such a stressful experience, but I'm actually pretty proud of how I handled it. I found some power in me that day that I didn't know I had. I didn't curse, but I stood my ground. I'm the type to avoid conflict, and as a small person, don't expect to ever win a fist fight, but I stood up to a person twice my size that day. And just so you know, you will never find us shopping at that store again. I'm brave, but not that brave. Thank you for sharing that. And it's interesting how sometimes we become different people when we get into a car. I remember when I first got my driver's license at 16, I remember thinking, oh my God, there are so many assholes in the world. It was almost like a light version of the anonymity of the internet. And for me, there was one time I was in college and I was driving and this car cut me off and we both slammed on our brakes and we got out of the car and I was ready to tear this person a new asshole. Like, what the fuck? And I saw it was a friend of mine. I was like, Bob, what's going on? Just completely different person. I think too, because cars are so dangerous that a lot of times are being an asshole is about fear. I think fear gets triggered easily because generally the two things that freak us out is that we're going to be late for something and we think our lives are going to fall apart if we get delayed by 30 more seconds. And the other thing is almost getting in an accident is fucking scary. I hit a deer like 30 years ago driving full speed. I was driving a full-size Jeep and man, that was fucking traumatizing. Obviously, a lot more traumatizing for the deer, but fortunately, the deer was killed instantly. But I was shaking. My voice was shaking. It. I don't know. I can fax you guys some more of my thoughts on cars, if you would like that. From the Fears survey filled out by Swimming Upstream, and she writes, I fear that I will regret not having children. I made the rational decision that I am not physically or mentally capable of raising a child, but I do fear that it will be a very lonely life. I fear that I will deeply miss out on all of those milestones like graduations and weddings and anniversaries, and then becoming a grandmother one day. I fear that I will never partake in those warm, fuzzy moments like cheering my kid on at a t-ball game or making a big batch of pancakes for my family on a Sunday morning. There will be no one to take care of me when I'm an old, decrepit woman in a diaper who can't get out of a rocking chair, and I will have to wear one of those horrible life alerts, but somehow I won't be able to get to it when I fall, and no one will find my body for weeks, and my cat will have eaten half my face. You are my new hero. That is so fucking fantastic. And I relate to that a lot more than I would like to admit. This is from the Back in Time survey filled out by The Name Goes Here, right? And they write, I'd go back to when I was 13, or was it when I was 12, to when I first started to fantasize about having been born as a girl. Coincidentally, it's also the time when my long spiral into deep isolation, suicidal depression began. I was also struggling with massive shame about my sexuality. I had a fetish, and I'll leave it at that. I'd tell that kid to stop beating themselves up for their, quote, weird slash perverse sexuality. They were no more or less weird than anything or anybody else. I'd tell them to stand up for their right to have their own interest and taste, and to not live in fear of being different, and to stop trying to please their parents by being, quote, the quiet one who never wanted anything. And finally, I'd tell that kid who never understood why they never fit in anywhere to Google the word transgender. If she had just known that it was possible to not be stuck in the box of assigned gender, she would probably have been able to avoid spending her adolescence spiraling into a suicidal pit. She would have had the community she needed to not hate herself for existing. Wow, thank you for that. That was so deep. So deep and beautiful. Thank you. This is from the same survey filled out by Beep Boop. And she writes, I want to go back to my 8-year-old self and tell her that it would all be okay. I'd tell her to talk to the teacher, to the brownie leader, to any and every adult that would listen. I'd wrap her up and give her a hug and tell her that we are smart and beautiful and that she is worthy of love. If I could, I'd leave her letters for when she was a little older, telling her of how we fought for the right to marry whoever we loved and won. Of how, in her own little way, she helped win the fight to repeal Ireland's abortion laws. Thank you for sharing that. I always love when something is filled out by a listener from another country. This is from The Struggle in a Sentence, filled out by Lou, and about her depression, she writes, a black hole in the chest that takes over my body and drags me to bed. Oh, that is so good. About her anxiety, like a fizzy drink you shake and hasn't been opened. Those are great. Thank you for that, Lou. Lou. This is from the Shame and Secret survey filled out by a woman who calls herself Spotted Dick. For those of you who don't know, I believe that is an English dish. Very unfortunately named. Let's see. And she is 17. She was raised in a pretty dysfunctional environment, or I should say is being raised in a pretty dysfunctional environment. She identifies as asexual. Ever been the victim of sexual abuse? Some stuff happened, but I don't know if it counts. I don't think it counts as sexual abuse, and I don't think he means it as that, but I always feel oddly sexual about it. My dad does stuff like rub my back and shoulders from behind and kisses my neck while telling me how beautiful I am. That is fucking creepy, and that is absolutely covert sexual abuse. And the label doesn't matter as much as the feelings that it leaves you with. He'll kiss me, not on the lips, but on the face, with spit and tongue and everything. I find it so disgusting. It is disgusting. It always makes me feel super weird, and I fucking hate admitting it. I've told him I don't like being touched, so say anything you want from a distance. And he'll agree in the moment, but then do it again anyway. Your dad is a narcissist who, excuse me, is perpetrating covert incest on you. That your body is your own and your dad is not respecting that. And he is sexualizing you. He is objectifying you. And that, of course, is going to fuck you up and make you feel unsafe. Your dad needs therapy. And I'm so sorry that you're probably still living under the same roof as him. I can't remember much from my childhood before the age of 11, but I do remember always being frightened to be alone with my dad. I had this intense fear that he'd for some reason get mad with me and kill me. I don't know why. He always tells me I'm his favorite from my brother and sister, and as far as I know, I'm the only one he acts this way with. It reminds me a lot of that Woody Allen documentary I'm watching right now called Pharaoh versus Allen, or Allen versus Pharaoh. Very, very disturbing the way he interacted from the get-go with his daughter. She's been emotionally abused. My mom would spank me when I was little on the butt, thigh, arm, and on the face when I did something really bad. Rarely enough to leave bruises, though. But again, I don't remember a whole lot from when I was little, but a lot of yelling went on. My parents would fight a lot. My mom did the yelling. My dad did the banging doors and throwing shit. I think I would just hide in my room and play with my imaginary friends and toys. That must have been a really hard is a really hard environment for you to stay present in. Who wouldn't retreat into their brain? And I very much relate to that. The way my mom touched me and talked to me until I began trying to set boundaries, actually, in my 20s, and still just, you know, would listen occasionally, but any positive experiences with the abusers? My dad and I do get along sometimes, mostly in the summer because that's when the cricket is on and that's the only thing we both enjoy. Except now there's a lot more women's cricket and he's super sexist, so I can't wait for those arguments. Darkest thoughts. I want to gather my family underneath a high building and have them watch me jump off of it. I just want them to see how much pain they've brought upon me. I want them to feel bad for the rest of their lives, like they're responsible for killing me. Man, that is heavy. Here's something to think about. You don't have to kill yourself for you to kill that part of your life that you don't want to experience anymore. And it can start by setting boundaries. And I would recommend a support group or a therapist to help you learn how to voice what your boundaries are, to find even what your boundaries are. When you live with a narcissist with no boundaries, like you are living right now, it really confuses your sense of what is right and wrong, what you're entitled to, where to draw the line, and the result is black and white thinking and either, being obsessed with something that brings you pleasure or just wanting to throw it all away. There's a great article called Co-Narcissism by Dr. Alan Rappaport, and you can Google it. It's about 5 pages long, and it describes the effects of living with a narcissistic caregiver. And you might find some comfort in that. Darkest secrets. I once put a pin on the seat of one of my teachers I absolutely despised, and her reaction to the pain was fucking incredible. To this day, it makes me feel so good thinking about it. Some background to her, though. If we weren't doing incredibly well academically and behaving like angels, she would yell so loud at us, put us down, call us names, and tell us we're stupid and how we'd go nowhere in life. We would, no exaggeration, go home weeping. So I'm not even ashamed of this. She deserved it. I'm actually proud, ? This was not meant to happen. What, if anything, would you like to say to someone you haven't been able to? I would just like to tell my dad to fuck off and tell him how much of a controlling, selfish, narcissistic piece of shit he is. Then leave and never come back. What, if anything, do you wish for? I wish I didn't have to think about everything I do. I want to not feel judged when I'm out walking my dog or buying coffee. I just want my mind to leave me alone. Have you shared these things with others? I tried to with one of my closest friends. Backed out of that pretty quickly. A lot of people will not be able to understand the experience that you have had and are currently having because it's complicated. It's not on the societal radar as much as it should be. There's a book that I recommend all the time called Silently Seduced by Kenneth Adams. And anybody who relates to what I'm reading from this survey should check that book out. How do you feel after writing these things down? Like a drama queen. I feel like I'm making this all up in my head and none of it is actually as bad as I think it is. No, it is as bad as you think it is, and you are not a drama queen. And you deserve to feel safe. You deserve to feel safe and autonomous. And here's the bad news, is you're going to have to be the one that starts setting the boundaries and self-parenting yourself because you have two parents that are incapable of recognizing your needs. They failed you. They failed you. And that stunts us emotionally. And so we tend to deal with things in black or white. You know, I'm either going to let them do what they want because I don't want to make waves, or I'm going to kill myself. And the answer is somewhere in between. And you might have to wind up cutting contact with your parents for a while or even permanently, but you don't have to figure all that out right now. It's just baby steps of learning what your needs are and what you like and what makes you feel safe and being there for yourself. But it takes work, but man, you're worth it. You're worth it. This is from the Back in Time survey filled out by Grief Girl, and she writes, I'm 27 now, but I want to go back in time a few times to tell myself some things that I didn't know and then that I do know now. To me, at 10 years old, the girl that made you play house, a.k.a. take off all my clothes and touch me, was probably projecting out her own abuse from someone else onto me. It's going to be okay. You're going to get over the shame that you feel and know that it's not your fault, and you will heal from this. To 14-year-old me, that 18-year-old guy that took your virginity and broke up with you right after was a real piece of shit. You're not a whore, and he took advantage of you. You were way too young to be put in that situation, but remember always, it's not your fault. One day, you will find love. To 21-year-old me, you were just diagnosed with bipolar after suffering from mental illness for most of your life. Cut yourself some slack. You're doing the best you can. Things will get better. To the 23-year-old me, I know that you're pregnant and your boyfriend just died, and right now you feel like grief will swallow you whole and that you'll never be a good mom. You're going to bring a beautiful baby boy into this world, and he is going to be half of you and half of the love of your life. He is going to live on forever through this baby. It's a blessing, and you are going to be an amazing mom, and you are going to experience love like you've never known before. Wow. Fucking wow. Thank you for that. And I'm so sorry for your loss. You really sound like quite an amazingly resilient soul. Thank you for sharing that. This is also from the Back in Time survey filled out by a guy who calls himself Cheapskate. And he writes, I would go back to when I was in and around the age of 8 to 9, when my dad would say to me after one of my hockey games, I don't know why we spend so much money on new skates for you when you spend half your shift laying on the ice. I would tell my younger self that it's okay to have feelings, that it's okay to tell somebody that they hurt your feelings, that it's okay to ask for people for help, that it's okay to stand up to non-constructive criticism from your father. It's okay to explain to your father that he hurt your feelings. I would tell younger me that it's okay if I don't want to play hockey anymore, if I don't want to. I would explain to younger me that his father loves him with all his heart, but that he doesn't know how to show it properly because his father never showed him. I would tell me about all the struggles that his father had to face as a young boy because his father was an alcoholic with untreated mental illness. I would tell him that his father, while not perfect, is trying his best to be a good father and break the cycle of alcoholism and violence that plagues the family. I would tell him that his father will eventually figure things out, but that he could help his father to achieve that sooner by opening his heart and helping to lead his father down the path of love. I would explain how much his mother loves him, even though she never expresses it. I would explain to him how cold and indifferent his grandmother was to his mom. That his mom is doing the very best she can with what she has. I would explain to him that his mother never feels well, but she works really, really hard to keep six kids and the household going. I would explain to him how much helping his mother would mean to her, even if she never asks for help. I tell him that he is a wonderful, curious, intelligent, and creative person. That it's okay to be yourself, no matter who that self is. That he deserves to love and to be loved. And that the world will have its struggles, but it will get better. If he stays true to himself, he will continue to be a wonderful person. He will face some struggles along the way, but he's strong and caring, and he will get through it and will live a meaningful and happy life. I would tell him that I love him. Wow. Wow. And that sucks that your dad ruined hockey for you, because hockey is such a fucking great sport. Thank you for those. Man, that was beautiful. And then finally, this is a happy moment filled out by walking in the snow. And he writes, I was walking my dog and came across the place I was sitting while planning suicide less than a year ago. As I stood there, remembering the darkness and hopelessness of that time, my dog Alfred, the cutest brown pit bull you'll ever see, started playing in the snow. Suddenly, I was smiling and so glad that I'd texted the crisis line rather than killing myself. For a brief moment, the pain and anxiety I still deal with melted away, and I couldn't have been happier watching him in the snow. Wow. Wow, that is some deep shit. And I'm so glad you're still here to have shared that with us. And I'm just so grateful for these surveys that you guys fill out. It is, they're so moving and they're so enlightening, and they really help make this feel like so much more than me doing a show. I'm just speechless. If you guys are out there and you're feeling stuck, please ask for help. It's so worth it. There's so much that we think we know that we actually don't know. And so many experiences that can be awaiting us if we just open our mind and ask for some help. I'm so glad I did. And just remember, you're not alone. And thanks for listening.
Everybody I know is bizarrely beautifully
everybody
fucked up
I know
in some weird way.
Bizarrely beautifully
everybody
fucked up in some weird way.
Bizarrely beautifully
everybody
fucked up in some weird way.